thank you all for coming. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome you to Radio Poetics. And first of all, I have to thank 313 and the Ontological, especially Tiana Kennedy, for helping put all this together. It's been really wonderful, and they've been totally supportive. But perhaps we owe a round of applause to Joe, who's back here been transmitting. Okay, so we have four performances for you this evening, beginning with a lecture from Joe behind me, who'll be speaking to us about the location of radio poetics, we can locate it, what a radiophonic poetry might be. After which, we'll have a couple of questions from Kareem, who's made it something of a pursuit so far, to be asking questions of poets and theorists. You all know, I'm sure, his radio show, Septuetics, where he's been talking to contemporary poets over the last year. He'll be having a reflective interview, which is exactly perfect, since so much of those interviews have been wonderfully self-reflexive and aware of the radio space that they have inhabited. After Kareem, we'll have a short break, which will be followed by Alexis Bagat, who will be performing a new polyvocal radio play, The Four Voices. And then I'll be doing a sound poem. But first of all, Joe, who will be giving us a lecture. I met Joe a few weeks ago talking about, one of our first conversations was about Ronald Johnson's radios. And later on his blog, which I invite you all to visit, is the site of his explorations and investigations into Patterson, the William Carlos Williams work, and trying to locate that work, or the poetics of that piece, in the location of Patterson, and finding where those two spheres overlap. I thought I would introduce them, Joe especially, by reading a small section from the program, which hopefully you've received. If we don't have enough and anyone doesn't have one, please let me know and I will send one to you by mail. In a way, Joe Malunas can be thought of as a Sundance kid in the realm of contemporary theory. He shoots quick and is one of the true, I think, mystical alchemical theorists who are trying to expand the field of what can be done in thinking about darker realms of ether. His book, Ether, The Nothing That Connects Everything, released by Minnesota in 2006, was a pleasure to read. And then to introduce it, I'd like to read just a few words from Christopher Knowles, which I think are appropriate. Maybe, I don't know the words, I can't say them. Sundance Kid is beautiful, and the story is about the Sundance Kid. And the movie's about the Sundance Kid, and the Sundance Kid is beautiful, beautiful, yeah. The Sundance Kid was beautiful, yeah. The Sundance Kid is beautiful, yeah. The Sundance Kid is very beautiful, yeah. The Sundance Kid can do the dance a little bit. The Sundance Kid could dance around the room. The Sundance Kid could walk around the room. The Sundance Kid could run around the room about the houses, houses of trees. So, with that, this is Joe Malunas.
Very sweet. Thank you, Danny, for that introduction. One of the things, as I was preparing this talk, I couldn't find it. I was looking for this letter. I just moved, so everything's in boxes, and it probably doesn't exist. And probably it would be less interesting if I actually found it, because it's my memory of it as a lost letter is probably more powerful than the actuality of it. But it was like maybe 1991 or 1992, and I was thinking somehow, you have to appreciate, some of us who are older can appreciate this, some of us that are younger maybe not so much, that, around, in the early 90s, it was really a great void, concerning radio work in general, interesting experimental radio work in general. And some of us might have listened to Joe Frank, or maybe if we were lucky, we might have gotten a tape of Gregory Whitehead or various other people that I was turned on to early. So, you know, for some reason I thought, I had got this cockamamie idea in my head. I was like, you know, Ireland has this really interesting tradition of radio as it relates to their history and relates to certain aspects of the rebellions in the early 20th century. And they also have this tradition of orality and poetry. So I went to find, you know, for lack of anybody else, I was like, well, maybe there's radio poets in Ireland. And I wrote a letter to this guy, and I actually got a response. But that's actually just to sort of give you a sense of how far afield one had to go to find this elusive category that I want to talk about tonight. You know, now we're in a situation where radio work is a little bit more ubiquitous, but it still kind of has hit us in the face. It's really hard to say, you know, if we want to do something that's called radio poetry, it's hard to say what it is and where we can find it. Radioactivity is something that is all around us, but as we know about radioactivity in general, it's something that's hard to detect. So if we've only recently acquired the instruments to detect this, it might be something, however, that's been with us all along. So that's what I want to talk about today is, or tonight, you know, where it might have been always behind the scenes rather than something that's particularly new. Poetry seems ready-made for radio and radio poetry. I'm going to actually sort of take a little... over here. Maybe I'll sort of get my Red Bull because I will get gummed up very fast. Okay, so, and there has indeed been a history to this, to radio poetry, or at least certain instances. Whenever you're talking about radio, you know, there are voids and disconnects between these particular instruments, and that's what's interesting about the drama of radio, is that it's about a certain sense of miscommunication and lost signals, as well as the clear channel. But if Garrett Stewart is to be believed, poetry wasn't even hearing itself at a certain point in recent history, let alone was it transmitting. The sway of Derrida, I put this as a hand in the audience, somebody's waving, I thought there was a question already. Anyway. so Garrett Stewart talks about how the sway of Derrida and his ilk engendered what would be called the suppression of the phonotext. And correspondingly, in the 90s, we had a kind of Derridian backlash when people rediscovered just how much sound mattered and just how much radio inflected or infected poetry. And just a sort of little gloss over Derrida, you know, Derrida posited sound as this kind of metaphysical supplement accruing to text, you know, as if words could fly to God without their textual circuitry, as if sound saved text from being mere noise. And it was always a confusing distinction. It took me a while to wrap my brain around this. It's a very confusing distinction for American avant-gardists, because for Cage, he had already posited sound as the secular noisy category and music as the metaphysical. So you have on the one side, you know, you have Derrida saying, you know, just to sort of schematize it here visually for you, you have Derrida saying sound is the metaphysical supplement to text, and then Cage is saying that music is the metaphysical supplement to sound. So you can see how, you know, that can be fairly confusing. So for Derrida, but not for Cage, sound creates its effect of transcendence paradoxically by reinforcing the illusion of self-presence, a kind of, you know, what you might call an auto-erotic mystique, warding off knowledge of the fragment, of loss, of death, and the other. And, you know, we don't need to have Derrida necessarily for this insight. You know, we had, early in the 20th century, we had the Futurists and their radiophonic physical folia, and then there was Brecht, who, when talking about radio, had this to say of our obsessive self-presencing. He said, "Nothing is more inappropriate than the old-fashioned opera, which is based on the inducing of a state of intoxication, for what it finds in front of the set is the individual. And of all alcoholic excesses, none is more dangerous than solitary drinking." So
you know, if we just think about, then what happens, what happened in the 90s up to this point when we have radioactivity all around us, but we weren't even quite sure whether we were hearing poetry. You know, we have, you know, as part of this Derridian backlash, if we want to sort of posit this as somehow true, we could say that poetry slams return to sonic self-presence with a vengeance, splicing multiculturalism and identity politics, but maybe just beer-soaked hubris with the live word. And then you had language poetry, which had a more fraught relationship to Derrida, keeping the écriture, but having no, but not having any problems with sound, because maybe it was Cage's sound after all, and not Derrida's. But if you know, if you read something like Of Grammatology, and I put like a whole bunch of scare quotes around this, so there's like scare quotes out to the horizon. Derrida always thought that pure textuality was an impossibility, and that we always had to give way to what might be called pneumatological as well as grammatological exigencies. So, you know, we have to breathe, basically. But this is all sounds, right? This is not radio. So we could say that while it took post-structuralism to productively alienate us from our speaking voice, radio poetics, and this is pretty tangential, so we can argue this, but so we have sound, we have sort of post-structuralism alienating us from the speaking voice. Radio poetics might go in the opposite direction. So, I mean, just dig this for a second. Okay, so if you take standardized radio, it doesn't take much for standard radio, just as it is, to be alienating or uncanny or disconcerting, not to mention bureaucratized, aggressive, monetized, and stupid. And that's something that it takes a lot of specialized training for us to realize about our own voices. So while sound poetry as an avant-garde technique, so we can think about people like Henri Chopin or François Dupron, went in the direction of an alienation, we could say that radio avant-gardism maintains the possibility of access to a lost whole. And I want to qualify this because, you know, there's something about poets like Chopin that when they try to return to some sort of source of primal energy or the vibratory, the vibrations behind words, that there's something in that that embodies the radiophonic project. So, you know, the separations are not clear ones. Some facts about radio poetry. Since 1986, the United States Navy has been producing 2,300 radio poets per month. The poet, or the primed oscillator expandable transponder, is a radar jamming device dropped from fighter jets and sometimes carried by another device called a flirt, F-L-Y-R-T. While the combination of poet and flirt might imply that the Navy's idea of radio poetry is a courtly one, we are still far behind in terms of the speed of production. And if you look at Danny's beautiful little packet right there, I didn't sort of bring up a PowerPoint presentation, but there's an image on page 6. And I couldn't get an actual image of the poet, but if you turn the next page, and this is from the Naval Institute World Guide to World Naval Operation, the Naval Institute Guide to World Naval Weapons Systems 1997 to 1998. This is where I conduct my research. If you sort of look on the page after the page where the radio poet is, you see this sort of picture of this guy, and I don't know, he's dealing with some sort of weapons, missile, projectile thing, but he looks like one of the Beats, you know? What is the Navy doing right? But my main point is not to shame you about the Navy's prodigious production of poets, but to qualify this hole to which radio poetics might return us. If we think of the whole of the radiophonic universe, it paradoxically includes jamming, so, you know, the breaking of holes, as well as war, ethereal transcendence, and also heads getting blown off. Radio, in fact, is what ties us to war in ways that past generations did not have to negotiate. In Wallace Stevens' The Noble Rider and the Sound of Words, an essay that surprisingly has little to say about the sound of words, although it seems that he's many times on the verge of describing the poet as a transmitter, he says that the war is only part of a warlike whole. The Napoleonic era is regarded as having little or no effect on the poets or novelists who lived in it. But they did not have to put up with Napoleon and Marx in Europe, Asia, and Africa all at one time. Accordingly, with all that impinges on our consciousness, it would be a little twee if this lost whole were only to be found in some poetry cozy corner, where poetry on the radio sometimes ends up. But it should be clear that this is not the issue, at least exclusively, of poetry on the radio, but maybe of poetics of radio technology, or even, more accurately, a radio poesis, where the act of composition occurs uniquely at the dangerous evanescent contact with the radiophonic. And I wonder, I was thinking, especially because me and Danny have been talking about Ronald Johnson's radios, and you know, sort of got me thinking about the epic again. And I wonder whether this contact with the whole buzzing, vibrating, living necrosphere has its appropriate analogy in, or even maybe a direct extension of, the spirit and the technology of the epic. The consciousness, you know, we don't really think about the epic much nowadays. Because, you know, it's steadily eroded by the Kammerspiele comforts of the novel or the data overloads of secondary electronic orality. More facts about radio poetry. For thousands of years, radio poetry has existed in the form of what Homer called epia pteroenta, or winged words. These words were spoken by heroes of the epic, but it was also assumed that their wingedness referred to their mode of transmission by various bards. Their wingedness referred to their mode of transmission by various bards. It was a formula that the entity called Homer used to open up the space for poetic vocalization, distending realistic time into something worthy of transmission. Basically it would be something like, Achilles is about to bring back his spear, and the poet says, it's just about to fling it, and the poet says, and the fleet-footed Achilles spoke these winged words. And it goes on for 10 verses, it's kind of like here, yeah. And so it kind of stops time in some way. So the melee of war is happening, and this is going on for verse after verse after verse, and we've kind of leaped out of the time space of the battle and are on the air. If transmission and historical time are no longer as easily separable in the age of embedded reporting, and feature's simultaneity makes it so that these reports no longer create a sense of culture but of its dissolution, we still have something like the "and fleet-footed Achilles spoke these winged words" echoing in the pat formulas like "we take you now to Grover's Mill" or "live from New York, it's Saturday night." Winged words exemplify what Blanchot called the enormous tautology of transmission. They transmit the message, "I am transmitting." They buy time and express an emptiness. But they may also, and they can also, institute a rhythm and sonic patterning germane to both oral and electronic cultures. It may be, for example, that about 80% of NPR's broadcast day is composed of various modalities of these empty, yet perhaps poetic, formulae. So if the epic, then, is full of winged words as well as winged beings, it still doesn't present an easy flight, and constantly strains against the fall. These are stories of exile and nomadism and the dread force of rumor unleashed. And we can now, probably at this point in history, appreciate that it might not be original sin or the displeasure of Hera or subprime mortgages that are the cause of this fall, but something within language itself, no matter how powerful its broadcast system. So perhaps it is more interesting when radio poets admit that what goes up comes down. Homeric author. Homeric authoritarian culture gives way to the decadent itinerant rhapsodes who would stitch together the remnants of oral culture into elaborate routines bearing sometimes little resemblance to the original. And you could also cite when Ezra Pound talks about the abominable dog biscuit of Milton's Paradise Lost, and you have Ronald Johnson coming in and erasing Paradise Lost and coming up with radios. You have things, tell me, O muse, sing, O goddess, of the anger of Achilles, of arms and the man I sing, or sing, heavenly muse. These patent evocations of an otherworldly tune-in are turned on their head by the switchboard poetics of Burroughs, Spicer, and Philip Dick. And William Carlos Williams, fully embracing the fall of winged words in his remake of the Latin and Greek with bare hands, tells us bluntly, music it for yourself. And, as Danny was saying, I've been working on this one project about Williams and Williams's Patterson, the epic of New Jersey. And, he is the consummate poet of the thing. And we could say, though, that he extends this thing into its radiophonic double in ways that are less obvious than in other modernist poets, for whom, as Adelaide Morris says, sounds cut in, rise, then fade away as other sounds intrude, as if we are tapping into the party line on a municipal phone exchange, spinning down a radio dial, or sampling a stack of records. Except for the War of the Falls, which is a kind of analog to radio static, there's really no radio in Patterson. Any actual reference to radio might have struck Williams as too jazzy. An instance by then also of modernist kitsch. Yet Patterson's whole composition, it has been said, was inspired by one of his unillustrious neighbors, David Lyle, who Paul Mariani describes as an old radio operator who had settled in Patterson to devote all of his prodigious energies to one extraordinary project. By dint of hard work, he had turned himself into a one-man information station, reading and digesting everything he could get his hands on in an attempt to discover in that aphasic river of random words just what were the central energies and patterns of the times. Blake-like, he moved into the tonnage of news media pitch blend in order to extract what Williams had called the radiant gist, the luminous center. Lyle mailed off his missives, sometimes 5 or 8 or 10 pages long, single-spaced and glossed, to artists, musicians, poets, politicians, engineers, in short, to whatever names he found in the news. It was as though he had managed to freeze the very radio waves themselves and make their energies visible in ink as they flowed through the thousands of names and places and especially verbs that were in the air at any given moment. And there's actually a, on page 19, they're not really paged, so I had to go and sort of count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so it's the 19th page of full text in Danny's booklet. There's a sample of, it's not David Lyle's actual text because Yale has them and they've been sort of under wraps for 2 years. They've been doing something with them for some reason or another. So the best I could get was a copy of William Carlos Williams transcribed some of David Lyle's texts that he'd been sent. He's basically a proto-blogger. I mean, he'd go out and he'd just sort of write up these whole things and then he'd just go through the information systems and try to condense it. And it's a really interesting little quote in the booklet that you should take a look at when you go home. But, one of the things, I can't stand artist talks, but I did want to talk about my project, Patterson, a little bit, and that's why I kind of lit up to this at the end. So I'm making a little bit of an inelegant leap, sort of one thing and then the other thing, right? But one of the interesting things about the radiophonic is that, I started saying, well, maybe it's about radio technology, but for those of us who know a little bit about radio history, know that what radio does ends up getting co-opted by other technologies, right? So you have, in the 50s, what radio was doing in radio drama got co-opted by television. Television was doing it better, so radio had to reinvent itself. You know, so if you have in the 90s, you have this sort of consciousness about radio coming back. Well, a lot of things that are happening in the internet now, you know, are sort of, you know, sort of could have just as well been done on the radio. And there's a very interesting continuum between radiophonic avant-gardism in the 90s and new media avant-gardism. And so, you know, when I started this blog and this large audio project about Patterson, I called it Radiophonic Patterson because I was going to do something with a sort of live radio feedback loop with the falls, and I was going to do something with musicated easy passes. You know, I was going to get somebody to sort of figure out a way to sort of, like, you know, when they're going through the, you know, you just got to pick up the electromagnetic signals from the easy passes and turn it into some symphony. You know, that never panned out. Might still, if there's anybody in the audience that wants to help me out with that. But, so, you know, it turned into more like a sound blog project. And, but it was still seemed to me radiophonic, precisely because of the way in which it dealt with sort of expanding Patterson into something that, you know, who's out there listening to this or reading this? You know, what's the relationship between the sort of transmitters and the receiver? And there's a kind of also, you know, I'm trying to get at in Patterson. Everybody talks about the, you know, the materialism of Williams, right? And but there's something about it that also has this vibratory modernism, this kind of radiophonic modernism in the background. There's a lot of other reasons, but, you know, maybe in the end I'm going to play a clip from this. And it's a clip, for those of you who do follow my blog, which might be maybe two of you in the audience, but for those, you know, two, you're going to even be surprised, because it's nothing I've posted yet, but it's actually my favorite clip so far in the large-scale audio piece that I'm working on. And Kareem, is this all ready to go? Can I just... Yeah. How are we doing for time? Okay. This will be it then. So I'm going to just play a little clip from this project. And the voices that you'll hear for the most part are from interviews that I did with Bob Perlman and Lytle Shaw.
There's a moment early on where he says, "Blot, make a song out of that." Concretely,
what does it mean, music it for yourself? That there is music,
the surface
in this sound of any of this
presence,
the
surface.
Blot. Music it.
There's a moment early on where
is that clipping up there, Tom?
It's over here.
Oh, what? Who?
Yeah.
Oh, Tom, is it clipping?
It
sounds like it's.
Yeah,
it sounds nasty.
From your side.
Well, I have it. I'll put it about sort of 3/4 of the way on the quick time.
Okay, sounds good. Go for it.
Okay.
Yep.
There's a moment early on where he says, "Blot, make a song out of that concretely."
What does it mean, music it for yourself? That there is music,
the surface
in the sound of any of this
glistens,
the language
only the surface.
Blot.
That in a way, I suppose he musicked it for himself as he wrote it.
Synthesis. Blot.
And now you, in reading,
I'm nothing. The surface surrounded by
music itself. Implying too, I think that there's not a single music. So
it's this idea of the poet not being able to do that, and so having to become a field worker, having to constantly walk around and explore this blotness, this resistance of material towards synthesis. Right. On one hand, compiling huge amounts of material and making comments on it and working around it, but never sort of saying, now I found the total symbolism of of Patterson.
Now dig in, and you have a nothing. The surface surrounded by the surface only
and in
the
surface.
Resound. Dig in, and you have a nothing. The surface surrounded by
Paul was a machine.
Paul was a machine, as it were.
Paul was a machine.
Paul was a machine, as it were.
Paul was a machine.
Paul was a machine, as it were.
Impossibleobject.blogspot.com. Jeez, pug. mic should just sit here if you want to come up next, right?
Joe, will you grab your mic?
Oh, yeah. Okay, what do I have to do? Tell me.
Talk into it.
So, Joe, I wanted to ask you once the mic comes on.
We got it, sir.
Do we have sound?
I got sound over here.
Tiana?
And I didn't move anything except for I moved everything back and I just touched the master.
Okay.
But what is it going into? Is it going into?
Okay. Yeah, we got it now. Yeah.
Try it again.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.